If you appreciate the open source intelligence you're getting on this show, please subscribe at truthjihad.com or make a one-time donation by way of the PayPal button. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett here, looking for the best people to help spill the secrets and correct the misperceptions. Today I have one of my favorite long-term regular guests, Barbara Honegger. Barbara is a former presidential policy advisor, author of October Surprise, one of the great researchers and activists in the 9/11 truth movement. And we've got quite a bit to talk about right now. There's all sorts of craziness happening in the world, and some of it actually is easier to understand if you have a certain amount of experience with how things work at the higher levels of government, et cetera, et cetera. And Barbara has that experience. So, hey, welcome, Barbara. How are you doing?
Well, hi, Kevin. I'm not sure that anybody's previous experience can explain Donald Trump.
Yeah, I'm not so sure either. It's getting crazy. And you know what? One of the themes, I just wrote an article about this for the Crescent International, which is the best Muslim current events publication. And so many people are freaking out over Fire and Fury, the Michael Wolff book, telling us how dumb and crazy Trump appears to be, what all the people that Wolff talked to supposedly said that. And this just ties in to Trump's bizarre behavior, including these nuclear war threats, like the Fire and Fury threat. If North Korea keeps threatening us, we're going to rain fire and fury on them. The threatening
to... that's where he got the title for his book.
So threatening to nuke a country, kill millions of people because they've threatened you verbally, that's pretty strange, pretty bizarre. And so the subtext here is what's going on with Trump. Is he an unfit commander-in-chief? But there's a deeper issue, Barbara. I'm reading Ellsberg's book on the nuclear command and control system. It's called The Doomsday Machine, brand new book. And obviously, we have a huge problem with control of nuclear weapons. It's not just the crazy commander-in-chief. The whole system is crazy.
We've always had a huge problem.
Yes. In fact, it was almost worse back when Ellsberg was involved in it around 1960. At that time, they only had one plan for fighting Russia, and that was to nuke every single city in Russia and China and kill well over 500 million people, including 100 million plus, in our allies and neighboring countries that had nothing to do with it. And if Russia attacked us, they were going to still nuke China right off the map. And that was the only plan they had. And so Ellsberg freaked out when he saw that. And it's gotten marginally less crazy since then, but only marginally so, it seems.
Well, just marginally so, and nothing's really, really seriously changed. That was the so-called mad, still is, the so-called mad doctrine, mutually assured destruction. And the logic, which is a heinous logic behind it, but the logic behind it and the assumptions behind it is that you had to threaten your global rival, whoever that was, the global rival of the day. You had to threaten them with absolute annihilation and vice versa, so you wouldn't ever start.
But see, wait Barbara, let me stop. Well, that's the public story. But as Ellsberg tells us, that's not the case. This was all about first strike. It was not, survivability, so you could, do a deterrent strike after they shot first. That was a factor. But for the U.S., especially up through the early to mid-1960s, it was all about being able to clobber Russia first in such a way that they wouldn't be able to retaliate with very much at all, which is why the Joint Chiefs were trying to get Kennedy to hammer Russia with everything he had, killing hundreds of millions, and they assured Kennedy that he would only lose 10 million Americans. This was at the time of the Berlin crisis. Only 10 million Americans.
I understand that. And it's where I believe that the massive missing trillions have gone to these huge underground facilities, probably not just in the United States, but around the world, for the military, industrial, whatever, super intelligence superstructure to survive. But nevertheless, I do understand that. I've read the reviews of his book. I haven't read his book. I do know Daniel Ellsberg. He's just one of the national heroes, no question about that. But I do believe that this first strike mentality, this first strike policy, basically, it's still part of the mad doctrine, because it doesn't work unless the other side, at least covertly, is let know that you're willing to do that, and vice versa.
And the trouble is, though, it might work for a while, but then, you know, the other side comes up with something to counter it. Now, Ellsberg personally actually wrote the speech that Kennedy gave that forced the Russians to back down on the Berlin crisis. The Russians were saying, we're going to let East Germany throw you guys out of Berlin. And so at that time, see, the Air Force had made up this BS story that there was a missile gap. The Russians had way more ICBMs than we did. And the truth was that Russia had exactly 4 ICBMs and was totally bluffing, and we could have easily knocked out their ICBMs in a first strike. So Ellsberg wrote this passage for Kennedy to give in the speech to let Khrushchev know that, in fact, we know that you guys only have 4 ICBMs and we can take them out, so you guys, we'll win if it comes down to a nuclear war. And so they phrased it not quite that directly. Khrushchev had to back down, but this humiliated Khrushchev in front of his own hardliners. The result was a massive Russian nuclear buildup and the Cuban Missile Crisis. So this first strike threat
didn't
help.
And Trump just did the same thing to the leader of North Korea.
Exactly.
He basically said that. He said, my button's bigger than your button. And so he's been humiliated, and they're going to have a buildup. And are we going to have a South China Sea missile crisis? I don't know.
And this raises the question of, to what extent is the president, you know, how important is the president here? Because, you know, when it came down to JFK versus his own military and other, you know, powerful entities, JFK lost in a very nasty way. And that set a precedent, and now we have this crazy Trump in office tweeting this and that, but does it really matter? I mean, who's really in charge here?
Well, I think on the previous program that we did, I gave you my opinion. I'm not a nuclear war expert, but I have worked in the White House, and I have worked in the White House during the Cold War, and believe it or not, I was involved with meetings with top Air Force Pentagon aides over the MK missile program. So I'm not uninformed about my answer. I believe, and on the last program we did, I pointed out that not only did Kennedy get taken out by effectively, in my opinion, the military intelligence superstructure or deep state, whatever you want to call it, of the country, but so was Nixon taken out. Nixon had threatened to use nuclear weapons in Southeast Asia. And the military, at least the sane part of the active duty military, the brass, weren't going to let him do that. They weren't going to let him do that. So in my opinion, Trump has made himself so clearly pathologically dangerous to his own Pentagon intelligence community, they would not allow him to press the button, even though there isn't an actual button, as you know.
Well, this raises the question.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, that's a well-informed opinion. And it raises the question of how does this button work? And this is where, again, Ellsberg's book is really interesting. I haven't finished it. I'm halfway through, so I don't know what he's going to tell us about how the system changed. But when he was working there through the 60s, it was very much like it was depicted in the film Dr. Strangelove. In fact, Ellsberg says that when he and a fellow Rand Corporation nuclear expert came out of the theater from Dr. Strangelove, they were shaking their heads and saying, wow, that was a good documentary.
But
it was actually the reality.
I hope not the ending.
The rest of it. But the thing was that the reality was actually worse than it was depicted in the film as far as no tight presidential control, because in reality, what had happened was that, you know, Eisenhower had signed a release basically giving these next level down commanders authorization to go ahead and use nuclear weapons in the circumstances that they lost communication with him and thought that they needed to. And then they went ahead and delegated that same thing to the next level down, and they delegated it to the next level down, and there were no safeguards to prevent many, many thousands of service people, in many cases individually, not even the two-person key thing, from going and just starting World War III, which was instantly going to turn into 500 million people dead. So it was really nuts.
If I recall correctly from reading about Ellsberg's new book, there was a Russian general who the whole Russian superstructure during the Cold War, the military intelligence superstructure, believed that there were American missiles, nuclear weapons coming towards their country. And this general, his on a gut instinct, he waited long enough to be able to know that it was not the case.
That's right.
It was some kind of glitch on their computer screens. And one man.
Yeah, and he violated the protocol. They fired him afterwards,
yeah,
because he had violated the rules. If he'd followed the rules,
exactly,
World War III would have happened. Yeah. So, yeah, that's one of many, many cases of these false alarms and breakdowns that came very, very close to creating a nuclear exchange. In fact, it's really a miracle that there hasn't been one yet. And
I was just going to say,
yeah,
Kevin.
Yeah, it's either Allah or it's the UFOs or somebody is making sure it doesn't happen, or we're just getting incredibly lucky.
Well, you know, when this kind of thing, when you look at all of the times that we could have completely wiped ourselves out in the actual history of the Cold War, okay, let alone all the conventional wars that killed millions before that, right? But during the Cold War, when the United States and the Soviet Union, still under Russia, they still do, but they have these massive numbers of extremely deadly nuclear weapons. Now there are a number of other countries that do as well. When you actually read the history of how close it came every time on literally a thread, I almost get the sense that we leapt into another universe.
Wait a minute. How would
that
work?
I don't mean that literally from a physics point of view, but it feels like some kind of science fiction novel where, yes, that war did start, but there's something about life that saves itself in general, and that the whole life of the planet, the whole planet itself, went into another timeline.
Wow, that sounds like The Man in the High Castle.
Kind of a,
Philip
yeah,
K. Dick book.
The Man in the High Castle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, Trump's the man in the high tower. You know, he is the man in the high tower.
Oh, no. I don't know about that, Barbara, because in the original book, The Man in the High Castle is essentially the writer who's writing the alternate history story, only he's living in the worse alternate history. And if Trump, I don't think he can even read books, much less write them. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Well, I have to confess that I didn't know the plot line. I thought that the man in the High Castle was supposed to be Hitler, and then it was an alternative history.
Well, yeah, I guess you could see Hitler as a man in the High Castle, but the actual title character is the novelist who's living in Colorado writing. He's living in the alternate history in which the Nazis and Japanese won the war and split up North America. But he's writing his science fiction novel about an alternate reality, which is actually our reality, where the Allies won.
Okay, well, what I was referring to kind of awkwardly there was my understanding that it had to do with what would have happened if Hitler had won and was in power.
And
that's
definitely
the high tower.
Yeah, that's part of it. I highly recommend the book. It's quite good. And the TV miniseries was interesting too. It's about the only TV program I've watched in the last three decades, and it was worth watching, I guess. But getting back to the issue of who's the man in the high Oval Office, and does he have control over the nuclear button, and is his button bigger than other people's buttons, and does it matter that we have a lunatic who's getting into Freudian contests with with Kim over in Korea? You know, people are panicking and saying, Trump needs to be removed, 25th Amendment, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, man. I think maybe having this dysfunctional administration in there is good, because it prevents the evil empire from doing even more bad things than it probably could if it had a competent president.
Well, I'd have to disagree with that.
Trump's so bad, he's good.
No, he's just so bad. He's really bad. I'm sorry.
Okay. So you've been following this business. Yeah, go ahead. Tell us why it would be good to remove him and what the chances are.
Well, that remains to be seen, but we need, there are two major things are going to happen. I don't think that Mueller is going to be removed. I think Mueller is doing something very serious. As you know from previous shows we've done, and we're going to talk about that on this program, some of the updates. The Trump-Russia collusion thing is at least on the personal business side, the Trump organization side, is very serious. And all of this is going to come out, in my opinion, and there will be tremendous pressure to remove him from office or to force him to resign like Nixon. And that is the scenario that I expect.
And what's your timeline here?
Well, if we're able to make it without destroying ourselves again with North Korea or whatever between now and the November election, I do think that if the Democrats aren't stupid again, like they closed down the government the other day, if they don't do something really stupid like that again, I think that the Democrats have a good chance of taking back both houses of Congress. And if that happens, we're going to see some kind of serious 25th Amendment and or impeachment proceeding. I think it's more likely to do a 25th Amendment, but who knows? My preferred scenario is the Nixon scenario, is the Watergate scenario. It's almost as if the whole, military, intelligence, mainstream media complex is setting us up to see the parallels right from the beginning with Watergate. And that's how it ended with Watergate.
But
and
isn't that suspicious?
Have the movie The Post. We have the movie The Post.
Right. But isn't it kind of suspicious, though, because, you know, we know that to some extent Watergate was a setup. You're saying Watergate was a setup by the good guys who were worried about Nixon nuking people. Well, Nixon was threatening to nuke North Vietnam, but some say Kissinger was putting him up to it as a madman strategy, and Nixon wasn't mad enough to actually do it. There's another interpretation. I think Russ Baker's interpretation is that the hardline military people didn't appreciate Kissinger and Nixon freelancing and going and opening up China and things like that. And Bush was a point man in the coup d'etat, the Watergate coup that overthrew Nixon. So there's some question about, you know, who were good guys here, if any of them. But if we see a replay of Watergate now with the media consciously putting out these parallels for us to pick up on, isn't that suspicious? I mean, because the controlled media orchestrated us during the Watergate coup d'etat. And is this another sort of deep state coup d'etat? And should we just go along with it?
Well, no. Now, let's be careful here. I didn't say that I was saying they were the good guys. You just asked me what I thought was going to happen.
Okay.
I wasn't making a moral judgment. Okay. I'm just telling you that my preferred scenario is that he will be forced to resign by what Mueller has found that probably won't even be made public. What will be made public will be bad enough, but I think he will be forced to resign by what the Alexander Haig of the moment, Alexander Haig went to Nixon, gave him an offer he couldn't refuse, let him know what they knew, and he could either face the music if he stayed in office and be removed one way or the other, or he could resign. And I think they're basically going to blackmail him with the facts. That's the important thing. The Republicans want you to believe that, and Trump wants you to believe that the whole Trump-Russia collusion thing, whether it's Trump organization or Trump campaign or Trump transition or Trump administration or some mix of the above, some combination of the above, they want you to believe that it's all just fake news. It's not. So the question is, how bad is it, and how much of the facts that Mueller can prove can they cock the gun to Trump's head? I mean, I'm not making a judgment that there's good guys and bad guys on either side. I do believe, however, that when push comes to shove, that the military intelligence complex is in charge.
Yeah, I would say, too, although there might be different factions to some extent there. Actually, before we move on, though, what do you think it was that they knew about Nixon that forced him to resign? Something much worse, you're suggesting, than anything in the public record.
Well, I'm not. I can't cite you where I have read and or know this. Maybe you will be able to. But my understanding is that there is a link between Nixon and the JFK assassination, and that there is also the missing 18 minutes of the Watergate of the Butterfield tapes, the smoking gun tapes of Watergate, that they weren't really missing, that they were able to hold what they knew that was in those, quote, missing, unquote, 18 minutes, and that it went back to Mexico, and it went back to the assassination of JFK. And so if Nixon wanted all of that Pandora's box to be opened, he could stay in office and face the music, or he could leave.
Wow, that's interesting, you know, because I think it was Haldeman who wrote in his biography that Nixon was in the habit of talking about the Bay of Pigs thing. And so he sent Haldeman, before Haldeman knew what that was, I think, over to Helms at CIA to threaten Helms and say, Helms, you know, if this problem we're having with Hunt, you know, who was arrested for the Watergate burglary, if this Hunt problem blows up, it's going to open up the whole Bay of Pigs thing. And then Haldeman reported that Richard Helms, the CIA director, freaked out and started screaming, "You go back and tell the president that this has nothing to do with a Bay of Pigs thing." And then Haldeman later found out that the Bay of Pigs thing was code in the Nixon White House for the JFK assassination. Yes. So
exactly.
Yeah. So they were. It seems like they were sort of blackmailing each other with that.
Yeah, they were blackmailing each other, but it was Nixon who was forced out, and of course Helms left too. Did Nixon fire Helms? I can't remember. He was forced to leave.
Yeah, I think he did. If you read Russ Baker's book, though, it seems that there was a deep state takedown of Nixon. And so we may be getting something like that. And so what do you think would be the really bad stuff that they know about Trump that wouldn't be made public, that would be, you know, used to threaten him and force him to resign?
Well, I don't know.
You don't have that security clearance.
I'm not on the inside of the Mueller investigation. I'm sorry. But I am on top of what's known publicly, and I literally scour the mainstream media, the hard copy, not just online, New York Times and the online Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal, and all of that every single day. And I have made some major discoveries about the Trump-Russia collusion thing. And I'd like to, maybe we could go into that.
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about
Because that's
that.
What I know.
Go for it?
Okay. All right. So the bottom line is what I'm about to tell you. I've sent to special counsel Mueller. And I believe I've copied you on that email, haven't I, Kevin?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I made a couple of very major discoveries, and this what I'm about to tell you and your listeners in a bit more detail than what is in the email that I sent you, Kevin, is based upon scouring public media, but you have to know enough, you have to have enough knowledge base to recognize a jewel or a burning data point when you see it.
So this is open source intelligence.
It's open source intelligence. That's what I do, and that's basically what you do too, I think, very, very well. Okay, so anyway, this is what I've learned. So how do I know what I'm about to tell you? The first piece of information, I want to give some context for the two burning data points, okay, that I've now sent to Mueller, just on the outside chance he didn't know them, so he could follow them up. And that is, for most of your listeners, they're probably aware that, at least according to Trump and the Republicans, that the only thing that really matters, they want you to believe, even though it isn't true, the only thing that really matters in the whole Trump-Russia collusion set of claims, nexus of claims, is this so-called Russia-Trump collusion dossier. We'll just refer to it as the dossier. Well, this dossier was put together. It was actually, the research for it was done by a man by the name of Christopher Steele, who happened to be British intelligence, MI6's top man for Russia analysis, for everything Russian in MI6 British intelligence. So this is an extremely connected, informed guy who's right at the top of the Five Eyes intelligence network that includes the United States, for everything that has to do with Russia. So he put together what's called the dossier. And that dossier was done by Christopher Steele, but he was contracted by to do the work during the Trump primary and campaign. He was contracted by an outfit called Fusion GPS in the United States. And the co-founder of that, Glenn Simpson, was recently, not too long ago, he was interrogated. It was called an interview, but it was an interrogation. It was not under oath. It was, quote, voluntary, unquote. But you still are not by law allowed to lie to Congress. It's a felony if you do still, even if you're not under oath. So he has recently given, at the time, classified secret testimony to the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the Senate Judiciary Committee. Well, Dianne Feinstein, bless her heart, I'm glad she did it. She was so outraged at the cherry picking of facts in these classified interviews, these classified interviews with the dossier researcher and author, Christopher Steele. She was so infuriated by their spin based upon cherry picked information.
Who spin?
The spin of the Republicans on the committee.
Okay, gotcha.
The Republicans were trying to turn the tables against Fusion GPS, they still are, and Christopher Steele, trying to say that the real conspiracy is between the Clinton campaign and the DNC,
right,
and Steele and Simpson. So anyway, but that claim is based upon cherry picked information from a classified document. These transcripts. So bless her heart, Dianne Feinstein just put out on her own unilaterally. She used her power under Gravel versus United States, the same power that was used to get the 28 pages released, and the same power that Mike Gravel used to start reading the Pentagon Papers in the United States Senate, get it into the Congressional Record.
And the threat to do that, of course, that was what got the 9/11 FISA bill or whatever the bill for suing foreign sponsors of terrorism through.
But the 28 pages it was the 28 pages being released because Mick Harrison and I personally, with Mike Gravel's taking Mick Harrison's Law Review article looking at the whole legal history of Gravel versus United States, taking it to the members of Congress who had read the 28 pages and educating them about their absolute immunity under the Constitution's feature debate clause, that they could even reveal a secret stolen classified information as part of their official Senate or House membership, and there is nothing that can be done to them. So back to Dianne Feinstein. So just recently, Dianne Feinstein took her power back, her Gravel versus United States absolute immunity as a member of Congress for saying and revealing anything she wants informationally and not being touchable, totally untouchable. She just published on her website, her Senate website, she published the transcript, 312 pages of Glenn Simpson's testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I have read all 312 pages, and I've now also read, just even more recently, the House Intelligence Committee, thanks to the efforts of Representative Schiff, the chief, the head on the minority Democratic side. The interview, they called it, with Glenn Simpson has now been, the transcript is now also been released. You can read that on the House Intelligence Committee website. So I've read them both.
Wow. Now that's serious open source intelligence.
Yes. Now, given how I know what I'm about to tell you, now I'm going to tell you these burning data points. They're smoking guns that I found. Okay. The first one that's really important is that everybody in the mainstream media, every newspaper article you read, with one notable exception I'm about to tell you, they all want you to believe that there's only one Trump-Russia collusion dossier. There are two. And I learned this, amazingly, buried on something like page A16, way down in the continuing page of a New York Times article. It was not online, but you have to read it in the hard copy.
Wow. Sounds like somebody doesn't want this to be spread around too much.
Not too much. It's kind of like putting out news you want to bury on a Friday night, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So anyway, but it's out there. And what you learn, this is amazing, during the primary season, when Trump was still running against Jeb Bush and Huckabee and, you know, everybody and their brother, there were 10 or 11 candidates, right? Mm-hmm. Carly Fiorina. When he was in the primary, there was the first dossier research on looking at Trump, Russia, organized crime connections with Russia. And guess who did that one?
Well, according to the email you sent me, Steve Bannon.
Steve Bannon was the executive chairman of the billionaire Mercers, the right-wing conservative Mercers organization called Government Accountability Institute. Okay? Bannon, during the primary period of the 2015, actually, and leading into early 2016, he was the executive chairman of their organization when that organization paid somebody, they don't say who, because Bannon didn't do the research himself, that's not who he is, paid somebody to dig up the dirt on Trump because their preferred candidate at the time was Ted Cruz.
Wow.
The
other dossier, the Christopher Steele dossier, has been called the dirty dossier. So this one could be called, what, the dirtier dossier? I doubt it's the clear dossier.
Well, you have to ask yourself, this new book that just came out that skyrocketed before it was even physically out in the public domain by a few days,
Fire and Fury.
By Michael Wolff. His main source for that book is Bannon, Steve Bannon.
Yeah.
And he makes the point.
Bannon sees that Trump's going down, is my interpretation.
Well, Trump, I think Bannon's trying to bring Trump down now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Bannon knows there's no hope, that it's a done deal. Trump's going down and Bannon is jumping out of the sinking ship into what he hopes is a lifeboat.
Well, the important thing that you learn from what Bannon told Wolf, and I believe that Wolf reliably reported it in his book, Fire and Fury, is that Bannon said, this is all the whole Trump-Russia collusion investigation. It's all the bottom line of it is money laundering. In other words, it goes back to the Trump organization, his business, and his business back at least two decades. Okay. And you wonder why he doesn't want his tax returns released. Okay.
Mm. Yeah, so, and I've been saying this on Truth Jihad Radio, and we've been writing it in Veterans Today for years. And who else will touch this?
Well, I don't know what you mean touching it.
Well,
I mean,
talking about it, Trump is a front man for organized crime, and he's been, his business is fronting and money laundering. That's been his whole career.
Oh, absolutely. And for the webpage that goes with the show, I'll send you a couple of articles that I really hope you link because they absolutely prove it. But we're talking about the Trump organization prior to the campaign. Okay, so this is the information that's in the first dossier. So you have to wonder, how come Bannon knew all about Trump's money laundering to be able to tell that to Michael Wolff, that he put it in his number one New York Times bestseller, Fire and Fury? It's because Bannon was the executive director of the Mercer's organization that did the friggin' research that is the basis of the first dossier that you learn about in the New York Times in this buried paragraph. Okay, so just on the outside chance that Robert Mueller didn't know about that, he does now because I've just informed him. Now, the next thing that's really big in my mind, after reading the transcripts, one's 312 pages, the other's about a little under 200, of the Senate Judiciary Committee testimony transcript of Glenn Simpson, who hired Steele to do the second dossier, okay, the famous dossier. The dirty dossier that everybody mistakenly thinks is the only dossier on Trump-Russia, okay. And then also the other transcript by the House Intelligence Committee. I've now read both of them. And lo and behold, in the Senate Judiciary Committee transcript, you learn something really, really important. Okay, before I tell you what it is, and this is in Simpson himself saying so, in the interrogation transcript. Before I tell you what it was, you need to understand that the dossier, this is the dirty dossier, the second dossier, everybody thinks it's the only dossier that isn't, that Christopher Steele Fusion GPS dossier is simply a compilation of a bunch of short memos. And anybody who wants to read this dirty second dossier of Christopher Steele and Fusion GPS needs to go to BuzzFeed, BuzzFeed.com, and they've got it on their website.
And of course, Trump is suing them for this.
Yes, I know. Yes, and I think they're going to win. But anyway, my good friend Danny Sheehan, you know, the world famous public interest lawyer, represented the New York Times in the successful Pentagon Papers case that is the precedent for why BuzzFeed is, in my opinion,
there's a
going
compelling,
to win.
A compelling public interest.
Yes, exactly. Okay, now, I mean, there's no more proof of compelling public interest but that we have a special prosecutor investigating the very thing. Okay, but anyway, so what you need to know is that in the Senate Judiciary Committee transcript of the interview with Glenn Simpson, co-founder of Fusion GPS, what you need to know is that not too far into that interrogation in the transcript, you learn that each one of those memos, which are kind of just gathered together and stapled together, as it were, to make about a 35-page quote dossier, unquote, it's a series of memos. Those memos are numbered, sequentially numbered. And guess what? There are five missing numbers. The first one that, according to his testimony, Glenn Simpson, co-founder of Fusion GPS, received from his subcontracted researcher, the MI6 guy, Christopher Steele, the first one is numbered 2016, the year 2016 number 80. Okay, now you have to ask yourself, where's 1 through 79? But I'm going to put that aside for a moment. So the ones that are in what's published in BuzzFeed begin with what's numbered 080. Now in the testimony in the transcript, one of the attorneys for one of the two sides, Republican or Democrat, they say, well, you know, can you explain this to me, Mr. Simpson? The second one in the dossier is numbered 086. What's going on here? Are there five missing ones, or is that just a numbering error? Well, Simpson says, oh, he doesn't say it's a numbering error, but he says, well, 086 was the only second one I got from Christopher Steele. Now, I don't believe that. I believe Simpson's lying, but the alternative is that there are five memos that should be in the dossier, if not for numbers 1 through 79 even, that Christopher Steele did not even give to Simpson, who is paying him.
But wait, Simpson's that. Testifying under oath, right? So he'll go to prison
no,
if he's lying.
Not. No,
okay.
He's not under oath, but it's still against the law to lie or intentionally mislead Congress.
Okay. Yeah, so
right.
So there might be five missing memos.
Well, or 79 plus five.
Right.
And then how many more on the other side? Okay. So what's been called the dossier that Comey himself took and briefed a summary of to Trump in Trump Tower during the transition, and also to Obama during the transition when Obama was still president, that so-called dirty dossier, the second dossier that everybody falsely thinks is the first dossier, that everything, according to Trump and the Republicans, is revolving around because they're falsely claiming its content is fake, it's only part of what Christopher Steele produced, number one. And number two, Bannon has his own dossier.
And what's in that?
Well, we don't know. But in my email to Robert Mueller, this special counsel, I propose that when he interviews or interrogates, whatever, he has subpoenaed Bannon. And I think that now Bannon has agreed to, quote, testify voluntarily. And therefore, at least at this point in the next, quote, interview, unquote, it's not going to be under oath. But it's still against the law to lie to a federal agent. So he still has to tell the truth or he can go to prison. He needs that Mueller needs to ask for that dossier that the New York Times has now reported buried in the paper. Are you there?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So what this means is potentially there's a fair bit more evidence of not just so-called Trump-Russia collusion, but also organized crime-related material. And of course, these two things are very closely linked because, you know, one of the issues here is that Mikhail Friedman, the biggest bankster in Russia, who's very close to Putin, apparently had a direct line set up, some kind of a special communications line set up with Trump during the campaign. And that's just one of the many apparent, some would call it kosher Nostra ties, other, you know, red mafia ties revolving around Trump. And is that stuff ever going to break into the mainstream media? That I just don't understand how somebody with as many, you know, mafia issues as Trump has managed to get this far without, you know, with the media beating him up about everything else under the sun except the most important thing.
Yeah, that's a very good question, although you could turn that coin over and say maybe he's in his position precisely because of those associations.
Yeah.
You know, it's very possible.
Right, because the whole media is mobbed up too, I guess. I don't know.
I know.
It sure seems
sure.
like it. I mean, they're mobbed up.
The whole thing is a total mess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they won't, you know, they won't breathe a word of truth about 9/11. So that tells you something.
Yeah, not the mainstream media, not yet. No, not yet. Although there have been some notable exceptions. There was the Valley Forge 9/11 conference. What year was that? I can't remember, but it was years ago. And that was covered on a pretty open-minded, relatively speaking, whole segment on Nightline, on ABC Nightline. So there have been, they had to, of course, throw in their conspiracy theorist meme. Some very serious information got out interviewing Dylan Avery and some others from that conference.
Yeah, but if the big journalism outfits like, you know, the New York Times or Washington Post or Chicago Tribune, LA Times, or you know, the TV investigative deal, 60 Minutes, if any of those people really wanted to focus on the incriminating facts of 9/11, I mean, they could blow that thing wide open without even half trying. I mean, you know, people like you and me and David Reagan, so many people have been able to just find these smoking guns that are so much bigger and more obvious than most of the kind of spade work that they have to do. I mean, it'd be so easy, and they still won't go there.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, that's a good segue into the next part of the show that we wanted to get into. And that is to bring people up to date on the very exciting action by the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry that is about to happen at the very end of this month in only, you know, a week and a half in New York City. And the reason that that's a segue from what you just said is that the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry Grand Jury Petition Committee, of which I'm a member, there are about seven of us on that committee, we have done true yeoman's work, as you will see soon, because the entire grand jury petition, about 47 pages, on January 31st is the plan. It should be up on the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry website. Okay, you can just Google on January 31st in the afternoon for sure, Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and you'll be able to read all of our grand jury petition. We are demanding a special criminal grand jury to the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York Federal Court. Okay. And there will be a press conference on the front steps of that courthouse, that federal courthouse in New York City and Federal Square. I believe it's that morning, 11 o'clock.
That's January 31st.
Wednesday, January 31st. Yes. And hopefully, Kevin, you'll be able to interview Mick Harrison, who is the the Director of Litigation and Vice President of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, who is the main drafter, although those of us on the committee inputted the information that he has put into the legal context, into the legal language that makes this into a hugely professional effort, not just to try to do our best to get a new special criminal grand jury looking at just World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, not the rest of 9/11 yet, but we will get to that. But also, most importantly, to educate the public, because there's also a major media plan to go with this. So this document, if anybody in the mainstream media reads these 47 pages, let alone the 2 inches at least of exhibits, the evidentiary exhibits that prove the points in the petition itself, calling for this new criminal grand jury, federal criminal grand jury, then they are not going to be able to deny it. It's the way it's written. It's the substance. It's the exhibits. It really hits you between the eyes like a 2x4.
So this is dossier number 3 that we're talking about tonight. And in some ways, it's the most important of these dossiers. I mean, it's bad enough if the president of the United States is hiring Russian prostitutes to urinate on a bed that Trump thinks Obama slept in. That's quite terrible. But this act of high treason on 9/11, murdering nearly 3,000 people, most of them Americans, to hijack the United States, turn it into an Orwellian dictatorship, and murder 32 million people, mostly Muslims abroad, in wars of aggression, which is the supreme war crime. I mean, this is definitely a more serious issue, really, than all of these shenanigans around the criminal buffoon Donald Trump.
Yes, and I like that you call it a dossier. I like that. It is the most important dossier, and it is the fruit of literally over 16 years of the 9/11 Truth Movement. And it's been an honor to work with Jane Clark and Mick Harrison and the other members of the Grand Jury Petitions Committee. It's been a real honor.
So this
it's a really important document.
So it's a two-pronged effort, I guess. It's got the legal plea to the district attorney who may or may not, you know, pick up on and run with it. Of course, the political pressure would tend to be on the side of not doing that. And then there's a media effort as well. And if there's enough of a media effort, then it could make that a little bit more of a dilemma for him, as well as help educate the public. And I don't know, I suppose you don't want to spring all of the details of the media effort at this point. We don't want to let them know what we're planning too early, I suppose.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Okay. So we're not going to talk about the naked person climbing the building with the neon hang glider flying into the White House or any of that stuff.
We've contracted with Stormy Daniels. Yeah.
There you go. Okay. there's a front woman for you.
Oh my God.
What does it take to get the attention of the American people these days? Anyway, Building 7 won't do it. So
I don't know. Well, it used to take going on a high wire between the top floors of the Twin Towers in New York City, but they're not there anymore. So yeah. I'm not sure.
Well, if you get the high wire to just hang up there without any towers to hang on it, with using your anti-gravity machine, maybe that would do it. Oh man.
Oh my God. So anyway, yes, we're about to have a third dossier. And I'm looking forward to your interviewing Mick Harrison, the litigation director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, hopefully just before that, so that maybe if we have listeners in the New York, New Jersey area, that will motivate them to go to the press conference on the steps of the federal courthouse in Federal Square in New York City.
That would be great to get a crowd there. I've noticed, though, that the New York media doesn't seem to want to cover 9/11 truth crowds. I've been in a few, including one huge one on one of those anniversaries of 9/11. Was it 2007, maybe? We had the whole Ground Zero area was a sea of black 9/11 truth t-shirts, and yeah, it was not even mentioned.
The most of those t-shirts, I believe, were Alex Jones's t-shirts.
That was back when Alex was doing really good work.
Yeah, that was when he was doing better work.
yeah.
So anyway, that's story. But I thought in this segment of the program, so we've discussed I've alerted people to be sure and listen to your show that hopefully will be able to go out a little bit before Wednesday, January 31st, to alert people to be, if it's still that date, which we expect, but you have to be sure before you show up on the front steps of the federal courthouse in Federal Square in New York City, which, by the way, happens to be the very self-same location where we held our really important and historic 9/11 truth event on September 8th, just past for the anniversary week in New York City, where my 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour was the feature. So it's the self-same square. It's called Federal Square in New York City.
Federal Square, that sounds like the place to be on Wednesday, January 31st. And I will try to record that interview with Mick Harrison ahead of time and release it. We'll try to broadcast that on No Lies Radio. The live broadcast will be that very Wednesday morning. But we can put it out there a little bit ahead of time to try to drum up a crowd, because that's obviously a worthy cause. Is there any way that this, imagining that things really play out well with this, and you know that we get a break in the 9/11 truth movement in the not too distant future, you think that 9/11 truth and this Trump brouhaha could somehow synergistically work together? I can imagine various scenarios. For instance, one scenario would be that Trump's going down, he has nothing left to lose, and he says 9/11 was an inside job. Would that help us?
I don't think that's going to happen. And the reason I don't think it's going to happen is because he's now connected by an umbilical cord to the radical right in Israel.
Yeah.
And he's just come out hard. He's taken this hard right turn, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And he's about to pull half of the funding away from the United Nations organization that funds the Palestinian refugees.
Yeah. Well, Wolf's book tells us that Bannon was pushing really hard for this moving the embassy to Jerusalem thing. And Bannon is associated with a sort of a nationalist Pat Buchanan style perspective that's not particularly friendly to the Zionists. And Bannon's big enemies in the Trump administration were Jared and Ivanka, Jared Kushner, the close friend of Netanyahu and Kissinger, and Kosher Nostra, Honcho. So Bannon, my interpretation here, I wonder whether, Bannon purports to be all about America first. And do you think Bannon might be thinking that, sometimes the best way to train a dog not to chase cars is to let him catch one? So let's give Netanyahu what he wants here and watch the world turn against him.
I don't think so. I think that Bannon and, this is just my opinion, but I think that Bannon and Jared Kushner had common cause in Trump's taking this hard right turn, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but for different reasons. That Bannon's motivation, I believe, is that he knows that's necessary to keep his evangelical Christian base. And we're going to get into how they've been misled as well.
Well, that brings up that New York Times article. Let's quickly touch on that. The New York Times just published this piece.
Let me finish answering that question, though. So I believe that the motivations of Kushner, I think Kushner is far more of an Israel firster. I mean, he's an Orthodox Jew. And he went with Trump when Trump put, I would like to know what was in that little piece of paper that Trump put in the Wailing Wall, right? The Western Wall, when Kushner and his wife were, his Trump's daughter Ivanka was standing right behind him. I'd like to know what was on that. But I think that Jared Kushner has a more Israel-centric motive, and that Bannon simply has a U.S. domestic political motive for doing this.
And this is where the New York Times article is telling us that 9/11 just by pure coincidence benefited Israel by pushing American conservatives into this hardline extremist Zionist camp that Bannon is now exploiting.
So actually, I believe I'm going to be able, or if if you, I believe you have the link to that, don't you?
Yeah, we can link that in the radio blog.
Yeah, let's link that.
Okay, so people can go to truthjihad.com and click on the radio link, and you'll see that.
Right. Okay. So, as is often the case with the New York Times, anyway, the headline of the hard copy paper, which I have the clip of the article in front of me, is usually a little bit different from the online title. So I'm not sure it will be identical, but the hardline copy title is how the, they should have said United States, how the U.S. right took Israel's side. So that's the hard copy title. It's slightly different, I believe. It's by Matt Fisher, and it was on the 22nd of January, the issue. So that was, what, yesterday. And I sent this to you because I was outraged by it. I was absolutely outraged by it because, as you said, Kevin, this guy who basically is very knowledgeable about the Middle East in particular, and his column is called The Interpreter. So he's supposed to give the big, broad, general context behind events that you're seeing happening that are reported in the New York Times. And his, what he wants you to believe, well, first off, a little context, historical context. There is a key fact in this article that, assuming it's true, and I believe it is, based upon polling, that I didn't know. But it does make sense. It rings true. And that is that prior to 9/11, this is the claim in the article, prior to 9/11, that the evangelical Christian base, the right-wing evangelical Christian base, which has been led to believe that they would be sinning against God if they didn't let Israel do anything it wants because God's promised the Holy Land to Israel. That's the bottom line, right? And that they have to let Israel do it anyway because of their all the pain and suffering of the Holocaust. And the guilt that we in America feel because we weren't the ones who did the pain and suffering. So that's basically the occupation of the American mind by these Zionist propagandists. Okay, so I'm putting aside whether any of that's true. Okay, but this is the meme. Okay, so he, according to the polling, this author, Max Fisher, says that prior to 9/11 was a turning point. He at least is clear in pointing that out. And that's new. I haven't seen that before. He says prior to 9/11, that the evangelical Christian base, the pro-Israel can do no wrong evangelical U.S. Christian base, which is the core base of the Republican Party and has been since Ronald Reagan, okay, for quite a while, 3 decades at least, over, that evangelical Christian base prior to 9/11, they were pro-Israel, but they didn't want anything bad to happen to the Palestinians. They need to think of themselves not only as moral and ethical, but morally superior to everyone else. Okay. But after 9/11, what Israel did, we'll get into the Israeli involvement in 9/11 in a minute, which makes...
Well, no, we won't, Barbara, because we're at the end of the hour, so we don't have time for that. So we have to summarize this.
Oh, all right. All right. So anyway, the bottom line is people need to read this article. It'll be on your website. And this author, Max Fisher, wants you to believe that it's just a coincidence that the evangelical Christians after 9/11 decided that it was okay to be against the Palestinians, that they were evil because they were Muslim. Okay.
That's right.
And Trump has used that. Trump has inflamed that intentionally, and he was elected because of it.
Exactly. So they're telling us that the direct line from this article is that this culture war against Muslims largely by chance aligned almost perfectly with a real conflict just then unfolding between Israelis and Palestinians. So the American culture war turning the right wing against Muslims and Palestinians just by chance. It just so happened that 9/11 happened and aligned it perfect, almost perfectly with what the Israelis were just about to do to the Palestinians. What a coincidence.
What a coincidence. That's what he wants you to believe when the truth, of course, is that it's Israel's own fifth column in this country, the Zionists, who did 9/11.
Absolutely, and that's a good place to leave it. So, hey, thank you, Barbara Honegger. I appreciate your terrific work. This has been a very interesting interview, and I hope to get back to you before too long, God willing.
Right, and look forward to your interview with Nick.
Okay, I do too.
Okay.
All right, take care, Barbara.
Bye.
Bye-bye.